This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The Israeli onslaught in Gaza claims scores of more innocent lives in the northern and central parts of the beleaguered Palestinian territory. U.S. Defense Chief Lloyd Austin is meeting with Israeli officials in Tel Aviv in the midst of their genocidal war against Palestinians. British Petroleum suspends its oil tanker transit through the Red Sea as the Yemeni military continues targeting more Israel-bound vessels in retaliation for the genocide in Gaza. Hello and welcome to World News. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, getting to the first story, of course, being Gaza, where death and destruction, dire shortages of food and water, and widespread displacement. This is the harsh reality facing 2.4 million Palestinians in Gaza as the Israeli regime continues its relentless strikes on the war-ridden strip. Scores of Palestinians have fallen victim to the regime's artillery targeting residential areas in the northern and central parts of Gaza. Now, the latest airstrikes on the Jabalia area have claimed over 110 lives. Air raids in a Nusrat camp in central Gaza have also left at least 50 people dead, and the regime's artillery shelled the maternity ward of the Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, killing a teenage girl and wounding a number of others. The Palestinian Red Crescent has slammed as extremely dangerous the shelling of the medical facility. Human Rights Watch has also warned that the regime is using starvation as part of its war campaign by blocking humanitarian aid and destroying agricultural land. Nearly 19,500 people in Gaza have so far been killed in Israeli attacks. Well, we were earlier joined by our correspondent in Gaza, Zder Al-Bala, with an update from the ground.
The last couple of hours were bloody and harsh for the Palestinian people and the Palestinian civilians across all areas of Gaza Strip. The Israeli airstrikes have never stopped for a while. The Israeli war plans have just targeted several residential buildings in the middle area of Gaza Strip, particularly Al-Maghazi and Al-Burij refugee camps, respectively. And more fire belts were carried out by the Israeli fighter jets against the agricultural lands in the middle area here in Gaza Strip. In Deir el-Balah particularly, the Israeli artillery maintained its shelling towards the houses of the Palestinian civilians, especially those who live in the eastern side and the eastern parts of Deir el-Balah city. And in other areas as well, particularly Gaza, inside Gaza city, the Israeli artillery also continued its shelling and targeting the residential neighborhoods, particularly Sheikh Ridwan and Ad-Daraj neighborhoods. We are talking about continuous Israeli airstrikes happening and taking place amid the continuous, relentless shelling practiced and carried out by the Israeli artillery. So we are talking about continuous targeting of the Palestinian residential houses, and we are in front of dozens of the Palestinian casualties and injuries on a recurring matter. These casualties are brought to the hospitals every moment.
Another U.S. official is in the occupied lands amid the Israeli regime's onslaught against the Gaza Strip. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin once again endorses Washington's unflinching support for Tel Aviv's genocide of Palestinians. And the Pentagon chief has already met with the regime's war minister, Yoav Gallant, in Tel Aviv. Assen is also expected to meet with other senior officials, Israeli officials including Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The meetings are expected to discuss Israel's plans for a transition to a so-called next phase of the war. Assen is the latest U.S. official to visit Israel since the regime began its bloodbath in Gaza in early October. Washington has been defying domestic and international outcries to stop supporting Israel's bombardment campaign against the defenseless women and children in the Palestinian territory. Now, the co-founder of the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier, says Washington tries hard to isolate the people of Gaza from any support, but failed.
America has worked very hard. Blinken was touring the region during the genocide in Gaza in order to isolate the people of Gaza and Palestine from any support across the region. But yet we see that support coming in. I mean, Israel has to be defeated in many, many different ways and probably several times before the threat can be lifted off the people of the region. And this military response from Yemen is very, very dramatic. I think in Washington, they're thinking, what on earth can we do? Can we expand the war to the entire region? But if they do that, there's 7 million Zionist Jews in Palestine and 300 million Arabs across the region who understand what's going on in Palestine and the overwhelming majority in solidarity with the Palestinians. So I think the options of America, and I could be proven wrong, but I think America's options are limited. They've got two aircraft carriers to defend Israel. Are they going to send another couple of aircraft carriers off the coast of Yemen? I don't think so. I think that in this situation, America and Israel are coming up against the limitations of their power. They've come up against it before, of course, in Lebanon and elsewhere, but they're coming up again against the limitations of their ability to terrorize the entire region.
A senior member of the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, says the group will not enter into a prisoner swap agreement with Israel unless the regime stops its onslaught on Gaza. Khalil al-Hayya says it would not be sensible to sign a prisoner exchange deal while Palestinians are under fire. He also says Hamas has what it takes to resist for months, adding whoever thinks of a post-Hamas era is delusional. Al-Hayya has urged Muslim countries to force the Israeli regime into allowing humanitarian aid to enter Gaza. Now, the top Hamas official argued that the entry of 100 trucks with relief aid is not enough at all for besieged Gazans. He says the resistance front will continue to counter the occupiers and inflict further losses on them. Meanwhile, the military wing of the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, has responded to Israel's discovery of one of their tunnels on Sunday. The Al-Qassam Brigades has told the Israeli forces that they are too late. In a video, the resistance says that the tunnels discovered by Israel yesterday were the ones used in Operation Al-Aqsa Flood on October the 7th. On Monday, the Israeli army broadcasted videos of a resistance tunnel near the occupied territories, calling it the biggest one ever uncovered in the Gaza Strip. Now, the tunnel unveiled is only a small part of the network of underground passages in Gaza. It is completely isolated and hardly measures 1,500 meters in a straight line. And now to the West Bank, where Israeli forces kill more Palestinians there in the occupied territory as they raid the Farah refugee camp in the Jordan Valley. The Palestinian Health Ministry says four young Palestinians were killed by regime troops during the incursion. Palestinians were aged between 17 and 24. Israel has stepped up its raids and attacks across the occupied territories since October the 7th. That's when the regime began its onslaught on the Gaza Strip. Since then, regime forces and settlers have killed more than 300 Palestinians and detained hundreds of others across the West Bank. Well, Palestinians in the occupied West Bank say they will not leave their lands despite the deadly Israeli raids. Now, this comes after Israel destroys the house of a Palestinian who's held in Israeli jails. The detainee's father says the regime is trying to force them out of the West Bank.
These are the targets of the Israeli regime inside Jenin refugee camp. The regime has bombed and destroyed houses of civilians while claiming it has targeted the resistance forces. This is a strategy that the regime has been using in Gaza. Israel kills innocent Palestinians and destroys their homes. Right now, we are standing on the rubble of a house that belonged to Tamer Mer'i, one of the Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails. The regime has bombed this house and razed the two-story structure. Adjacent buildings have also been destroyed. This is one of the thousands of houses in Jenin refugee camp that have been demolished during the regime's 60-hour operation. In this offensive, Israeli forces also partially destroyed several other buildings, arrested hundreds of people, and raided hundreds more houses and caused damage. Now we will talk to the father of Palestinian detainee, Mr. Mohamed Mer'i. Tell us what happened.
What happened was, thank God, I was not at home. There was no one in the house. I was out of the camp, but when I returned, I was shocked to see that they had blown up my house. Without any reason, they blew up the house. However, we will not abandon our home. This is our land. This is Palestine. And this area belongs to the camp. I'm not going to abandon the camp. I have grown up here, and I am not leaving it. Where are they forcing us to go? We will not leave the camp.
A global energy producer, British Petroleum, says it has suspended all oil tanker transit in the Red Sea over what it calls a deteriorating security situation in the area. Taiwan's container transportation company Evergreen Line has also halted shipments to and from the occupied lands in response to the recent attacks in the Red Sea. This after the Yemeni military attacked the Israel-bound ships in the Red Sea. In the latest of such attacks, Yemeni armed forces performed a special military operation against two ships related to the Israeli regime. Yemen's army spokesman says the operation targeted Swan Atlantic oil tanker and the MSC Clara container ship, following the crew's refusal to follow the Yemeni army's orders. Sana'a says the strikes are in response to Israel's genocidal war on the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Yemen has stressed that it will continue the attacks until Tel Aviv stops its ethnic cleansing in Gaza and allows food and medicine into the blockaded strip. While there's been no let-up in Israeli atrocities in Gaza, people across the world have also been equally unwavering in their support for Palestinians in the besieged territory. Let's bring you up to date with some of the latest pro-Palestinian rallies. French protesters call for a total and permanent ceasefire. They carried banners calling for the right of life for people of Gaza and expressed support for the struggle of Palestinians for freedom. Across the channel and in the southeastern UK city of Brighton, people also marched in support of Palestinians. The rally was a culmination of 20 local groups all calling for a ceasefire. Meanwhile, in the Canadian capital of Ottawa, protesters waved Palestinian flags and chanted "Free, Free Palestine" at a Zara store. Now, that's because of an ad campaign by the fashion brand featuring statues wrapped in white. Activists say the images resembled photos of corpses in white shrouds in Gaza. Zara withdrew the ad earlier in the week. Moving on to other news now this hour, the Israeli Prime Minister is facing harsh criticism at home over his handling of the issue of captives being held by Hamas. Israelis have been piling up the pressure on Netanyahu since three of those captives were killed by the regime's own forces in Gaza some days ago. One of the three slain captives was buried near Tel Aviv on Sunday. During the funeral, his brother slammed the Israeli military for abandoning and murdering him. The three men were waving a white flag and were killed near Gaza City by the invading Israeli troops on Friday. It sparked protests in Tel Aviv, where people vented their anger at Netanyahu and called on him to initiate negotiations to get the captives released. More than 100 Israelis are still being held by Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza. That's after a week-long truce in late November saw Hamas swapping more than 100 captives with 240 Palestinian women and children held in Israeli jails. Israeli warplanes have carried out fresh strikes on Syria, targeting the vicinity of the capital, Damascus. According to the Syrian military, the rockets were launched from the direction of the occupied Golan Heights. It added that the country's air defenses intercepted and shot down most of the missiles. The offensive, however, left two people wounded and caused some material damage. Israeli regime frequently targets Syria, particularly areas in and around the capital, Damascus. The Syrian government has on numerous occasions called on the United Nations to force the Israeli regime to stop its acts of aggression. Damascus says the assaults are in violation of international law and aimed at propping up terrorists. Well, now to South Korea, which says the Democratic People's Republic of Korea has launched another long-range ballistic missile that landed in the waters east of the Korean Peninsula. Officials in Seoul and Tokyo say the missile can potentially strike the United States. Japan's defense ministry says it was an intercontinental ballistic missile with a potential range of more than 15,000 kilometers. According to South Korea, the projectile flew up rather than across. Now, this is a method Pyongyang employs in some weapons testing to avoid flying over neighboring countries. The launch followed the test of a shorter-range missile on Sunday night. The DPRK says its missile tests are in response to the persisting joint war games by the U.S. and its regional allies and their hostile rhetoric. Pyongyang regards such moves as rehearsals for invasion. Well, a car crash targets the U.S. president's motorcade in Delaware. The car rammed into a Secret Service SUV, shielding the Joe Biden convoy. Reporters were asking Biden about his low polling numbers when the crash took place. He was leaving his campaign headquarters in Wilmington. The U.S. president was quickly ushered into his waiting vehicle, where his wife was already seated. The Wilmington Police Department said in a statement it is investigating the collision, which did not result in any injuries. And with that, brings us to the end of this World News edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
One aspect that often goes unnoticed when analyzing the situation in Palestine is what can be described as the occupation of everyday life. This refers to how the Zionist colonial regime and its settler colonial project are present even in the smallest details and in the most intimate spaces of Palestinian lives. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV noted, a political analysis of intimacy, particularly within Palestinian homes, will help illustrate how colonialism infiltrates even the most private corners, typically thought to be secluded or, at the very least, less exposed to the colonial entity. The intimate focus on politics also enables an observation of how the daily and routine presence of occupation affects the lives and interpersonal relationships of the colonized. For instance, through this intimate perspective, it's possible to analyze how receiving a home demolition notice impacts people psychologically, or how rebuilding a home each time it is demolished can ultimately affect the mental health of those involved in that process. This type of analysis should not be interpreted as a departure from studying colonialism, but rather as a means to highlight how invasive colonialism is, penetrating households. In other words, a perspective on the micropolitics of intimate spaces complements the macro-political analysis of colonialism. Palestinian homes are regularly evacuated, demolished, and raided. This violation of intimate space is neither recent nor solely provoked by the supposed reaction to the events of October 7th. For instance, in 2016, data published by Israeli regime media itself indicated an average weekly demolition of 20 structures. Another example of this home destruction was documented by the Palestinian journalist and author Ramzi Barud, who recorded in 2017 how the Palestinian Bedouin village of Al-Araqib was demolished more than 116 times. In addition to house demolitions, there are other ways in which the Zionist occupation manifests in everyday spaces, such as state harassment aimed at forcing residents to abandon their homes and eviction orders, which in the Palestinian colonial context could be defined as legitimization of that harassment. It's quite common for Palestinian families to be expelled from their homes where they have lived for decades. In the occupied East Al-Quds, there are areas where settler movements, supported and protected by the regime, military and legal structure of colonial regime, attack and intimidate Palestinian residents in order to evict them from their homes. Geographer Sabrien Amrouf highlights how violence and the occupation of daily life manifest in the military perception applied to Palestinian homes. In an infographic published in 2014 by the Zionist regime army titled "When is a House a Home?", a typical Palestinian home was portrayed from a militarized perspective. The bedroom was identified as an operations room, while the living room was considered an arms depot. Through this discursive exercise, the Zionist regime army justified its attacks on infrastructures that are typically conceived as civilian spaces, places of refuge and protection. This discursive process connects the two aspects of Zionist colonial occupation: the macrocosm represented by homes and intimacy, and the macrocosm represented by Palestinian territory as a whole. In both realms, the objective is to dispossess Palestinians of their homes and lands. Both colonial records highlight the entirety of the occupation, its presence in the daily lives of Palestinians, and the impossibility of finding spaces of refuge, both physically and politically. From the perspective of homes, it's crucial to note how they have ceased to be simple familial spaces isolated from the colonial exterior and have transformed into what are considered the battlefields. This unexpected intrusion of war into the private sphere of the home has represented for civilians in Palestine as well as in Iraq or Afghanistan the deepest form of trauma and humiliation. In this sense, Palestinian homes are no longer just spaces of increasingly restricted intimacy, but places of occupation, control, and dispossession. From the theoretical standpoint, a city in a normal context might be delineated by two types of walls: outer walls, defining its perimeter and shaping the public space, and inner walls, separating intimate or private spaces. However, in colonial contexts like Palestine, the separation between the public and the intimate disappears, the entire space is delineated by colonial occupation from open areas to individual rooms. The image evoked in the case of Palestine, where the boundaries blur between the exterior and interior of the home, is that of a concentration camp. In such a setting, there are no intimate spaces to seek refuge from violence. In Palestine, families aren't safe even within their homes. In their most private and intimate spaces, the colonization of everyday life and intimacy is another consequence of the Zionist colonial system, serving as yet another reason for resistance.
Ocean of Dua.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll adopt a thematic approach towards supplication, and we'll have a look at supplication from the point of view of different verses of the Holy Quran. And we'll also have a look at some parts of the transmitted supplications as well as the whispered prayers. So stay with us. Brothers and sisters, in the previous episodes, as you were previously with us, we were having a look at the first and foremost, the most important educational objective of supplications. We said that, of course, supplications are full of advantages. We even counted up to 8 or 7 different advantages and effects for supplications. And, of course, after mentioning all those advantages, we noticed the fact that there are some obstacles, some hindrances that the supplicant needs to be aware of. We, of course, said that even if our supplication superficially is not responded to, the mere engagement, the very fact that the supplicant has engaged in supplication is to a level, to some degree, a kind of response that we, all the human beings, need to be thankful for. But the fact is that there are some hindrances, some impediments that the supplicant needs to be aware of. Beyond that, there are some educational objectives for supplications that we were mentioning. We said that the most objective seen throughout the different parts of the supplications is that the Almighty Allah is referred to as the absolute cause by any kind of word and deed possible. For example, we read in the 36th supplication of Sahifa, وَأَنْزِلْ عَلَيْنَا نَفْغَ هَذِهِ السَّحَابِ وَبَرَكَتَهَا وَاصْرِفْ عَنَّا أَذَاهَا وَمَضَرَّتَهَا. O Allah, please bring down on us the benefits and blessings of these clouds. Turn their harms away from us. Allahumma adhib mahalla biladina bisuqiyak. O Allah, take away the barrenness of our country by your rains. Take away the distress of our hearts by your blessing. Wa akhrij wahra sudurina birizqik. Fa innal ghaniyya man aghnayta وَإِنَّ السَّالِمَا مَنْ وَقَيْتَ. The rich is the one whom you have made rich, and the safe is the one he whom you have protected. It is also said, اللهم إن هاتين آيتان من آياتك. O Allah, cloud and lightning, these are two signs of yours. وهذين عونان من أعوانك. You, these are your assistants. يتبدران طاعتك برحمة نافعة. These are the ones obeying you with profitable mercy or harmful wrath. أو نقمة ضارة. فلا تمطرنا بها مطر السوء. Please do not make them pour over us the rain of wrath. وَلَا تُلْبِسْنَا بِهِمَا لِبَاسَ الْبَلَاءِ. Please make them cover us with not the dress of distress.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, "Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad." Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy of God will come towards you. Paradise, thank you Allah, that we hear, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God speaks with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. Feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua. Elsewhere, we read in the supplications that the Almighty Allah is praised, and praise belongs to the Almighty Allah, who is the creator of such and such, and by counting the different instances of the creations of the Almighty Allah, the supplicant will be more cognizant, will be more aware of the different blessings of the Almighty Allah. And of course, he will understand how powerful the Almighty Allah is. And beyond and above all that, he will realize that there is only one absolute cause in this universe. Alhamdulillah alladhi khalaqa al-layla wa an-nahara biquwwatihi. This is the 6th supplication of Sahifatul Sajjadiyyah. Praise be to Allah, who has created the night and the day with His power. وَمَيَّزَ بَيْنَهُمَا بِقُدْرَتِهِ. He is the one who distinguished between them with His might. وَجَعَلَ لِكُلِّ وَاحِدٍ مِّنْهُمَا حَدًّا مَّحْدُودًا. He is the one who has made for each of them a certain limit. وَخَلَقَ لَهُمُ اللَّيْلِ لِيَسْكُنُوا فِيهِ مِنْ حَرَكَاتِ التَّعَبِ. He is the one who has created for them the night to rest from hardships of the day. So, it is really noticeable that in these expressions, every move and even every immovability is directly related to God. and the whole causality is ascribed to more aware Allah. Not just more, but most aware Allah. وَخَلَقَ لَهُمُ النَّهَارِ مُبَصِرًا He has created the day and made it bright for them. لِيَبْتَغُوا فِيهِ مِنْ فَضْلِهِ To benefit from their Lord's favors. وَلِيَتَسَبَّبُوا إِلَىٰ رِزْقِهِ وَيَسْرَحُوا فِي أَرْضِهِ To gain livelihood, to rove in his earth. طَلَبًا لِمَا فِيهِ نَيْلُ الْعَاجِلِ To get the necessary needs of their worldly life. وَدَرْكُ الْآجِلِ فِي أُخْرَهُمْ To ensure the later necessities of their afterlife. So, it is truly noticeable that the infallible imams have considered themselves as the manifestations of God's attributes. In some traditions, they consider themselves as the very content of God's attributes. However, the structure of the truth behind God's attributes is beyond our thinking and our imagination. What we understand, however, is that in all these instances of the transmitted supplications of the Ahlul Bayt, the power of the absolute cause is directly at rest. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to sit us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the Israel Watch program, which has observed the presence of immense difficulties that the occupation army is facing in the battles taking place in the north and south of the Gaza Strip, and doubts that the War Cabinet Council will be able to obtain for itself an image of victory. This is while the open front with Hezbollah at the borders with South Lebanon remains to be a source of worry, with fears that things might go down the hill at the time the Ansarullah movement simultaneously imposes a siege in Yemen on Israeli maritime trade. I welcome Mr. Hassan Hijazi, expert on Israeli affairs, to discuss these topics with us. Welcome to the show. Israeli media admits that the battles in Khan Yunis, south of the Gaza Strip, are very tough, remains the biggest problem for the Israeli occupation, and is really difficult to overcome. In addition to the difficulty in terms of confronting the Palestinian resistance in Khan Yunis, Zionist military experts admit that Israel is also facing such difficulties in Al-Shujaya and in Jabalia. Mr. Hassan Hijazi, this is a clear Zionist acknowledgement that the battles are tough in Al-Shujaya, Jabalia, and Khan Yunis, and explosive tunnels are the talk of the town today. What is the significance of these statements?
Well, this shows that what the Israeli occupation army rhetoric on having everything under control is mere talk. And the fact that the Israeli army, its soldiers and tanks, entered some places, this does not mean that it took control of these areas. This is proved by the different types of resistance the Israeli army faces, about which Zionist experts and officials are talking, including the issue of the tunnels in which numerous Zionist soldiers were killed. This is because the resistance seems to be using a crafty tactic against the occupation army by putting explosive devices in the tunnels or in their surroundings. And when the Israeli soldiers approach the tunnels, the resistance detonates the explosive devices, which means that Zionist occupation faces something similar to quicksand in these areas, which have become traps for targeting Israeli soldiers.
But they say these are the most fortified places in the world.
Yes, this rhetoric has started recently. During the first period of the war, the occupation regime estimated that the issue might take longer time than expected. And this implies two things: additional confidence by the army in terms of its capabilities, taking the Palestinian resistance lightly, and also the not knowing where it'll enter and what it will be facing. This is a multifaceted failure of the occupation regime, and it has to go over its calculations in terms of how to deal with these areas.
Anyway, this admittance to the difficulty of battles in the Gaza Strip was followed by endless questions on the potential of the occupation army, which Israeli leaders have been claiming is the strongest in the Middle East, but so far has not been able to finish a battle with a resistance front. The additional problem that the Zionists feel and has become the talk of the town in the political, military, and social arenas is the issue of the missiles that are being launched by the Palestinian resistance from within the Gaza Strip towards the occupied land and is causing instability to the Zionists. What is your take on what was said, that the resistance is still launching missiles up to now?
This shows that the occupation army was unable to harm or damage the infrastructure of the resistance. All the missile launching, bombing, destruction was actually targeting the Palestinian civilian infrastructure. The resistance prepared itself really well and hid its capabilities well too. It has engaged in multiple wars with the occupation and has gained high experience in dealing with the Israeli Air Force and its destruction capabilities, the intelligence, and its ability to gather information and build a bank of targets, and it has prepared itself well for it. It seems that the resistance has prepared itself and set up plans for fighting for long periods of time, even in case the Israeli army conducts land incursions into the Gaza Strip. This reveals the deep strategic thinking and long-term vision of the resistance, which prepared itself in this manner and is still fighting with such a high competence and able to achieve its goals.
The failure of the occupation army to annihilate the resistance and release the Zionist captives by force, which led to an increase in sharp disputes among the members of the war cabinet, which leads this aggression. What is the reality and extent of disputes between the leaders of the occupation and the war cabinet? Where can this reach and what is it all about?
Actually, since the beginning of this battle, there has not been any sort of harmony or agreement between Benjamin Netanyahu on one side and the war minister, Yoav Gallant, and the chief of staff, Herzi Halevi. In addition, there's also the newcomer to the war cabinet, who is Benny Gantz. This phenomenon was interpreted in many ways. Leaks also showed that Benjamin Netanyahu has his own agenda that is related to his political future and how he is trying to exploit the war for this end. And he seeks to fulfill his own personal and narrow interests that are internal and political, at the same time as Israeli media claims the others are focusing on the military effort. However, the others also have their own plans to attain political goals in terms of public opinion, which paves the way for the coming phase.
And this leads to divisions?
Yes, this is a reflection of the divisions. Each side is putting effort to gain more cards and blames others for failure.
So each of them has his own plans, and each of them is working for his own political gains now and in the future. How will this issue be reflected on the situation of the war on the Gaza Strip?
Well, there is consensus on some general issues related to this battle, but there are disputes over the major issues of this battle. So, for example, the vision of the future of Gaza after the war is not a united one. There is no consensus on this, even on the level of public opinion, and not only Israeli officials. There's no clear vision. There's no clear strategy to exit the war. And this worries the Americans, who have come with a clear strategy of a two-state solution with a Palestinian Authority at the same time, at the time Benjamin Netanyahu does not accept this and is supported by the extremist far right, at the time the left has no clear vision and is also not ready to accept a Palestinian state. And this pushes the political reality and the Zionist people into trouble.
The imagery of victory the Zionists are trying to find will not be realized, even if the occupation regime succeeded in killing the leader, Yahya Sinwar, and that is occurring to Israeli media. This failure to achieve the goals of the aggression and the increase in disputes which followed in the war cabinet yields one result. The image of victory that the Zionists are looking for will not exist, as former occupation, as Army Chief of Staff Dan Halutz said. So Mr. Hassan Hijazi, Dan Halutz, said there will be no image of victory in Gaza. What does this mean?
This means there is a confession to failure and defeat, and that the Israelis must not bet that the Israeli army will achieve an image of victory through the surrender of Hamas or its members, abducting or assassinating its leaders. This issue reflects that there is an acknowledgement that the war will not realize the results of which the occupation leaders have raised earlier. It will not be able to break the resistance. The resistance will remain steadfast with all its capabilities in Gaza. The maximum that the occupation regime can aim for is a period of calmness in the coming phase, and things might be worse maybe after a few years or so. The major point here is that despite all the supporting circumstances, the occupation regime and army failed in realizing a real victory against the Palestinian resistance in the Gaza Strip.
Moving on to the South Lebanon and the Front Hezbollah started in support of Gaza, its people and resistance in the face of the Israeli aggression. There's a lot of analysis in Israeli media about the current and future wars, which will be more painful if it takes place. Therefore, the damage that Hezbollah will inflict on the occupation regime in any wide-ranging war that might erupt cannot be eased except by removing the Hezbollah Redwan forces from the borders. Otherwise, this means that the settlers will not return to the northern settlements. Mr. Hassan Hijazi, what do you think of these Zionist estimates on the losses the Israeli occupation army will be inflicted with in any coming wide-range war with Hezbollah? And as we saw, the residents of the northern area will not return unless the Redwan forces are removed from the borders, and this is a major fear in their opinion.
Yes, well, the initial estimates of the Israeli regime have always been mistaken, and they always had to reevaluate everything and make correct estimates again, especially as it always gets surprised by facts and calculations that the Zionists did not see as coming. And this means that the war can be more costly and more dangerous. How will things turn out in this war? This is something no one knows or can estimate. Its scope, how it will happen, what the capabilities of the resistance are. The occupation makes its estimates according to whatever it sees, but there might be hidden elements that can change the scenario majorly. And this shows that the Israeli occupation keeps falling into the same mistakes in terms of its estimates. And this is what we saw in the failure of the Israeli intelligence in foreseeing the 7th of October events. This must push Israeli commentators and analysts in becoming more modest in terms of reading the future. Now, in terms of the settlers, it all depends on who will guarantee this issue and how will this decision be implemented, and are there actually options before the occupation on the political or military levels that can change the reality. Based on prior experience, the occupation regime has lost the initiative, and any error in its calculations will make things worse for its army and settlers alike.
Despite all that is said about a war with Hezbollah, it seems that the decision in the Zionist war cabinet is that there is no war in the north, simply because the occupation army cannot tolerate such a war simultaneously with the war on Gaza.
Well, Shimon Schiffer is not a simplistic mind in terms of reading the scenario, and he is reflecting the state of confusion which exists. There is no clear image in terms of the front against Gaza, the northern front, or both fronts together. And this reflects their general image inside the Israeli regime, which is in a major state of chaos and defeat in its history.
Moving on to the threats made by the Yemeni armed forces to the ships heading to the Israeli entity, in case food and medicine does not enter the Gaza Strip, which Tamir Khema, former head of the Amman intelligence, sees as a trade siege on the entity. Mr. Hassan Hijazi, what is the extent of Israeli fear from what they call the Yemeni Ansarullah siege on Israeli trade and maritime activity?
There is no doubt that this issue is a major challenge for the occupation regime because the siege can have a direct economic impact and can affect the daily life of settlers. The prices of goods and insurance costs will witness a huge increase because these ships will be forced to change route to come across Africa and the Mediterranean Sea through the Strait of Gibraltar. And this will also cause a delay of almost 1 month for goods to reach the occupation regime. All this will directly reflect on the life expenses of the settlers due to the increase in the prices of goods and commodities that Israel majorly imports from East Asia.
Commenting on the siege and the deteriorating economic situation in the occupation regime, Benjamin Netanyahu claimed that the situation is good and there's nothing to worry about, which angered one of the Knesset members. The statements of Netanyahu were mocked in Israeli social media platforms, and these are a few comments.
Movie. What else? 1,300 dead, 250 captives, a collapsed economy. What else?
Runit.
This is life. We have been at war since 2 months and the one accused of being responsible for the killing of hundreds of people and the captivity of hundreds is running an electoral campaign. A collapsed economy, soldiers being killed at battles, civilians being killed due to inconsiderate distribution of arms, and the stupid people will continue to vote for him.
Meir.
Netanyahu and the cabinet must be replaced. They failed on the military, security, political, and economic levels. Israel is now a defeated army and a collapsed economy.
Avi.
Dead, injured, captives, the Gaza Strip is destroyed. Soldiers sinking in the swamp of Gaza. Thousands of outlaws, a collapse in the economy.
So, Mr. Hassan Hijazi, we see a tough campaign against Netanyahu due to his statement. It seems that discontent has reached a new height. How will this impact Netanyahu's political future?
There is no doubt that Netanyahu is detached from reality, like some describe it, and he is trying to ignore the major issues of which the Zionist economy is suffering. The economy is paralyzed in the north and south. Some of the workers joined the lines of reserve soldiers and are engaging in war. There is a budget and an economy that will suffer from deficiency due to military expenditure. There are increasing woes on the economic situation, whether due to the military expenses or the direct and indirect damage. And Benjamin Netanyahu speaks as if everything is okay. There's no doubt that Benjamin Netanyahu, his family, and those surrounding him are living in a different reality than that of the people.
What does he intend to say?
Benjamin Netanyahu wants to ease the burden and say that he did not push the Zionists into a crisis. The crisis is related to the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza, and he bears direct responsibility, in addition to the general crisis the Israeli community suffers from on the economic and social levels.
Mr. Hassan Hijazi, expert on Israeli affairs, thank you for your participation in this episode of the Israel Watch program. Thank you. Until we meet next time, goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
For my roots in this soil, this holy land, the land which is yours and which is mine, Palestine. And you, good earth, glorious land, now I offer my son to you. See, I offer my son to you, only to you. I lifted his head from his mother's arms. I put him on your chest, still my roots, Palestine, 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 Palestine. Lullaby, my child, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. Since the story of my anger and your blood, the story of our mother's tears and your brother's cry, have to take us on, have to take us on. Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my dear, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. Since somebody inside my aching heart, somewhere deep inside our land, our blood joins in sacrifice, sacrifice. Your blood roots me here, this land. We'll be right back.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.